Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. After 4 days in court, two high school students, big athletes from Steubenville, Ohio, were found guilty yesterday of raping a 16-year-old girl one August night last summer. It's a case that divided a town and in some ways woke up a nation. Social media almost brutally, gleefully reported that ugly night. Then social media demanded justice when the town was unsure. It was as if the whole world weighed in. This hour on Point, social media, justice, and the Steubenville rape case. You can join the conversation. What is your take on the verdicts? Is social media changing how we react to crime for better or worse? Joining me now from Ohio is Rachel DeSalle, reporter for The Plain Dealer in Cleveland, covering sexual assault and justice issues. She's been covering the Steubenville case since the beginning and was at the courthouse in Steubenville yesterday when the verdict was delivered. Rachel, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
The town was famously divided over whether or not even to have these charges brought. What's your sense of how the community is reacting to the judge's decision of the verdict of guilty?
Well, I think it was a very emotional day for people on all sides of this case. It was four absolutely grueling days of testimony. I mean, things that people wrote in text messages and took pictures of that they would never want anybody to know, let alone the whole world. So I think it was a very difficult week, and that led to a very difficult day. And I would say that, you know, the town of Steubenville, you know, they didn't just pick up and move on the second that that verdict and that sentence was read. They still have a lot more thought and a lot more healing to do. And they also now have a grand jury that's being convened to look at, you know, additional possible charges against others who may have known about what happened and didn't report it or may have tampered with evidence afterwards. So I think that this chapter hasn't quite closed for them yet.
I want to look at that grand jury's work and what that may bring. I should say right here for all of our listeners, this case and this hour, this case certainly has a lot of graphic and difficult images and language in it, very explicit and very tough. So be forewarned in this hour as we try and respectfully discuss it. Rachel, take us to the verdict here, and what was each of these two young men found guilty of?
The 17-year-old young man was found guilty of rape and also found guilty of a charge based on a nude photo he took of the teen girl and then transmitted to other teenage boys in the town.
This is Trent Mays, who's 17 years old, who'd been the quarterback on the high school team.
Yes. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yes. And the other youth, Malik Richmond, who's 16, was found guilty of rape.
There was talk early on of kidnapping charges, potentially even, for the way she was kind of hauled around throughout that long night of parties. What happened with that?
Sure. The judge at an early hearing, what we would call a preliminary or probable cause hearing, decided that there wasn't really sufficient evidence that their motive was kidnapping her. So the judge dropped that charge early on, but let the others remain.
What will these verdicts mean in terms of incarceration?
Malik Richmond will serve about a year in a juvenile prison facility in Ohio. He could get out a little bit earlier because he already served a little more than 2 months when he was first arrested. But in Ohio, you're sentenced to a minimum sentence in the juvenile facility, but you can be kept longer if they feel you haven't been sufficiently rehabilitated, and they have kind of a metric that they go upon based on your crime and then how much rehabilitative programs that you've been through. Mm-hmm. So he could be kept till age 21. And the same is true with Trent Mays, though he has a minimum of 2 years. The judge said that because he also sent the photo and was convicted of that, and because his activities in the judge's mind were a little more egregious than Malik Richmond's, he was handed a longer sentence. But he could also be kept till the age of 21.
Now, why were these two tried as juveniles, not adults? I mean, they are 16 and 17, but we've seen plenty of cases around the country where in rape cases or others, it can go on up to an adult treatment. Why juvenile here?
Sure, that was at the judge's discretion. And in Ohio, the judge has discretion for certain crimes to keep juveniles in the juvenile court system if they feel that there's still a chance to rehabilitate them. I think because these two youths did not have any previous criminal activity, and the judge also probably relied on an assessment of them and their family life and their histories, he decided that it would be better that they be kept in juvenile court. If they had committed certain more severe crimes, it would have been mandatory that they were bound over, or if they had previous criminal records. But in this case, it was up to him.
Now, Rachel, this is difficult stuff for on air, but it may be important for people to understand here. The rape in this case was digital rape, which under Ohio law is just rape.
That's correct. It is counted under the definition of rape under Ohio law. In Ohio law, you know, rape would be penetration with pretty much any object, whether it be fingers, whether it be a penis, whether it be a different type of object. It all falls under the statute of rape. And it was very interesting during the trial because many of the teenagers who testified, including the victim herself, under, you know, questioning from the attorney, said that they did not have any knowledge that type of crime constituted rape. In their mind, the crime of rape was a very different crime. It was a forceful crime. It was a crime of sex that was forced on someone. They also didn't understand how a level of inebriation figured into the crime of rape. So many of the students involved in this, really before it happened, and I would guess many other teenagers in the town and elsewhere, really didn't understand what this crime involved.
You say it was a tough 4 days of testimony. We can believe that. What were some of the toughest elements of this testimony, Rachel?
I think it was really hard when they read for hours and hours and hours text messages that the teens had sent back and forth to each other. I've been a reporter for well over a decade, and I cover juvenile court, so I understand that they're, I understand the way that teens interact, but the language and the crassness that was used among many of the youth, the way they talked about each other, I found it to be quite upsetting.
Some people are just tuning into this whole case now. Like what was being said and discussed there?
So the casual nature in which they discussed rape and, you know, sexual activity and how they just in generally treated each other in a kind of negative fashion. There was obviously a ton of cussing and things like that,
yeah.
But, you know, that's nothing a journalist hasn't heard.
Right.
The way they discussed sending photos of people back and forth when they were naked, and I think, too, the photos themselves were very difficult. I think one of the hardest moments during the trial was when a photo that the teen victim had not seen of herself was shown to her. I mean, she really maintained her composure for most of her testimony. At that moment, she could not, because she had not seen the photo before.
A lot of the media has carried the photo of her being kind of hauled around by her arms and legs, hands and feet, like a sack of potatoes. What else was there photographically?
This was a much different photo. This was a photo of her laying on the carpet of the basement floor on her stomach, and both of her arms were underneath her body. I mean, she looked like a rag doll that had been flung over, and she had no clothing on. So it was kind of as just someone had just kind of tossed her down there and let her be. It was very hard for her to look at, I could tell. She had seen one other photo of her that was sent where she was also nude and, looked or appeared to be passed out, and someone had taken a photo that showed that there was a substance on her stomach that investigators later said they were able to test from a blanket that was semen. And so those photos were sent out for other people to see in a very nonchalant way. I mean, many teen boys were texting one of the perpetrators saying, "Hey, send me that pic, bro," or and they were referring to her as a dead body.
Better than OJ's wife. I mean, just awful things to hear and read. Those texts and photos and more may be related to an ongoing effort here and a grand jury investigation. What could come out of that? What was the attorney general suggesting?
You know, he wouldn't be very specific on what would be presented, because I think that their goal is to take witnesses in, let the grand jury hear them, and then let the grand jury ask questions. But under Ohio law, it is a failure to report a felony crime. That could be a possibility. It's also a crime to tamper with evidence after the fact. And many people have also zeroed in on the Steubenville football coach. There was a lot of information in the students' texts, and of course we don't know whether it's true, because some of the things that these teens said in their texts were true, and some of them clearly were not. But they said that they felt that the coach was going to take care of this problem for them, and they indicated that from the very early days he knew about it and was involved in the conversations with them about what was going on. And he, under Ohio law, would be a mandatory reporter. He would be mandatorily required to report any type of child abuse, and we don't believe that that was done in this case, and so would others at the school district who found out. So I don't know how a grand jury will handle that, but I think a lot of people do have questions about the coach's role, especially since he's such an important figure in that town. He's very beloved. I mean, the football field is actually named after him. So it's a very difficult position, and I don't know what will come of it.
Rachel, our time is short, but you cover these issues. You know this realm. Do you think this case would have come to trial? I mean, the original texts and photos were gleeful, brutal, callous, casual, but would this have come to this outcome without the social media trail of evidence and kind of a campaigning for criminal investigation later?
Yeah, clearly it's a much different case because of the social media, and it's had many different impacts. I mean, the victim never would have been able to piece together what happened to her or even know that she was raped at all.
Because she was so drunk, she says she was unconscious.
She couldn't remember anything that happened after leaving the one party. Prosecutors, if not for the initial social media posts, wouldn't have known who to key in on and get information evidence from. But at the same time, social media made the case much more difficult for prosecutors, because once Anonymous and some other groups got involved and threats were made towards people, witnesses stopped talking to them, and they almost lost some of their main witnesses. The judge had to give those witnesses immunity, or they were not going to testify.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Steubenville rape case, social media outrage, and now, over this weekend, a verdict. Guilty for two prominent athletes in an Ohio river town, Steubenville, that has become kind of shorthand for a new world of social media and its intersection, in this case, with crime. There's been a lot that has come out, a lot of grueling testimony over 4 days, just a tiny sample here. This was from a 12-minute video featuring Steubenville High School graduate Michael Dorianos mocking the victim. It went viral.
That's like rape. It is rape.
Bro,
they raped her.
You do it? Bro.
They raped her.
Bro, they raped her. Okay. Yesterday, after the verdict was delivered, the judge allowed the defendants to address the court. Here's Malik Richmond apologizing to the victim's family.
I would like to apologize to you people. I had no intention to do it. And like that. I'm sorry to put you guys through this. But just like...
I'd just like to, and then the tears. He and Trent Mays will be incarcerated. Here's Trent Mays, who, in addition to the rape charge, was found guilty of taking and sending nude photographs of the victim.
I would truly like to apologize to our family, my family, and the community. No picture should have been sent around, let alone even taken. That's all, sir. Thank you.
And if you think it's only in Steubenville, well, the Ohio State Attorney General Mike DeWine said yesterday, it's just not that way, that we as a society have to do more to educate young people about rape. And then there's the intersection with social media.
This is not just a Steubenville problem. This is a nationwide problem. This is a societal problem. What happened here is shocking. It's appalling. Well, quite frankly, what's even more shocking and appalling is that crimes of sexual assault are occurring every Friday night, every Saturday night across this country.
Ohio State Attorney General there, Mike DeWine, after the verdicts yesterday in Jefferson County, Ohio. Joining me now from Washington is Juliet McClure, sports reporter for the New York Times. She and her colleague, Nate Schweber, wrote a big piece about the Steubenville case back in December, brought national attention to the story, sparked online outrage. Juliet, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome, Tom.
And with us from Miami, Florida, is Marianne Franks, professor of law at the University of Miami. She teaches criminal law and researches cyber law and gender. She's been following this case very closely. Marianne Franks, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Juliet, first to you. You went to Steubenville, what, November, December, wrote a very big piece on it. And in all of your reporting at that time, you found townspeople who really were not at all eager, to say the least, to even talk about this or have attention brought to it.
Exactly. It was pretty amazing that really only a handful of townspeople were willing to talk about the case using their names. Everyone was really just frightened that they would get there would be retribution about what they had said, whether it's from the football team or other townspeople, because really the football team was the big thing in town and all the football players were heroes.
You reported then Steubenville, industrial city, kind of Appalachian there on the Ohio River. Locals loving to note that's the hometown to Dean Martin, the Rat Pack singer, the pornographic movie actress Tracy Lords, the odds maker Jimmy Snyder, Jimmy the Greek. If I read right, the high school football stadium could hold more than half the town's population, Juliet. Football is huge.
Exactly. The football stadium holds 10,000, and the town is about 18,000 and losing people by the day. So really, every Friday or Saturday nights, whenever they would play, people would gather in the morning, as early as 8 or 9 in the morning, in the parking lots of the supermarkets next to the football stadium to start tailgating for that night's game. So it's really the town was centered around football, was centered around these boys who played high school football.
Did you have the sense that population of young men felt somehow immune?
I would say definitely. I mean, obviously, from the texts that were read in the case, you would glean that they were not afraid of anything. They thought that the coach would get rid of it, that the coach was laughing about them, about the whole case and what had happened. They really felt like they could do anything. I mean, you would have to think that they would think that because they not only did these really terrible things to this young woman, but they put pictures of it online and put a video of them talking about it online and tweeted about it. I mean, they must have felt invincible if they felt like the whole Twitter and internet universe could be reading all their information of that night and they didn't think they would get in trouble for it.
Marianne Franks, what do you make of this case and how social media has played out in it? First, those rather brutal river of social media commentaries and photos from throughout that night and after. And then the campaign that grew up online and beyond to bring this to trial. What about the social media imprint on this case, Marianne?
Well, it certainly shows us just how social media can be used in many different ways, and it has all sorts of possibilities for not only encouraging really terrible forms of behavior, but might actually provide opportunities for us to discover some of that terrible behavior. So it's hard to say in this case that it was a good thing that so many events happened over social media, because we cannot forget that there was probably something to be said for the idea that social media helped create the crime to begin with, that there was a culture of spectacle. There's a culture of sharing, assaulting somebody as entertainment that's been created by social media. But at the same time, this is something that implicated these young men and actually has to show them, at least in this case, that they aren't invincible. They're not actually immune from critique or even punishment.
Juliet, what about this culture of spectacle? I think that's a good phrase for what we've seen coming out of this. I mean, the very casual, it seemed almost heartless or bland response to what looked, you know, what looks now to be really bad. How do you interpret the culture behind that, Juliet?
Well, I mean, one way you could look at it is saying that it's a culture of this gang mentality that a lot of football teams have, whether it's, you know, in the pros all the way down to high schools. I mean, they're...
But not all the tweeters and texters were football players, right?
No, all of them were athletes, though, baseball players.
Yeah.
There are a couple wrestlers. I mean, that's the one common denominator about most of the kids at these parties. They were all athletes. In fact, well, the ones that we knew that we could look up and cross-check with who was at the parties, most of them were athletes. And I'm not sure what that says about athletes in this town or athletes in general, but in terms of Trent Mays being the star quarterback on the team, and he was definitely the aggressor in the whole evening, where he was, you know, he was supposed to be with the victim and maybe was her boyfriend or something, and everybody was sort of following his lead. It was just a good example of sort of how he was the quarterback of the evening.
Well, let's get to our callers. Julius in Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. I know that town. Julius, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. What I'm calling for is, I'm 42 years old. Had I been 15 or 16 at the time, as those boys were, in a different culture than we are now, where we're more aware of what's appropriate and what isn't, might I have participated in that? I would like to think I wouldn't, but maybe I would have. But I know the boys now, they know what they did was wrong, but I think the way it's being promoted, if I just read a title of a newspaper and saw that these boys raped this girl, I would think that it was something brutal like you see happening in India, where this poor girl was gang raped, beaten within an inch of her life, and what they did was still wrong, but they touched her inappropriately with their hands, which is still wrong.
Yeah.
But these boys are also going to be labeled as sex offenders for the rest of her life, and they didn't do what it appears, the way it's promoted, as having been done.
Julius, you may not be the only one scratching your head on that front, but I appreciate your call, Marianne Franks. Let me bring it to you. You hear the distinction that's being Julius is trying to make there, and his how he's torn about it. It's not the New Delhi bus gang rape. You know, it's something else. It's digital. He's worried maybe it's too much. How do you look at it, Marianne?
Well, I think that that's maybe a dangerous distinction to make. Sexual assault is sexual assault, and of course there are different forms of sexual assault, but it would be just like saying, well, you know, cannibalism is really, really wrong, but killing somebody seems by comparison not so bad. That may be true, but we have to look at what is actually wrong here, and it's not just, you know, penetrating somebody with their fingers. It's called rape for a reason in Ohio. This is also reflecting the federal definition of rape, which has now been adopted. We have a much better understanding these days of what rape actually is. And essentially, what it is non-consensual sexual conduct. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just, you know, the penetration with the fingers. It's also forcibly undressing this girl. It's also attempting to have oral sex with her and failing, not being able to do so. This is the problem. It isn't a matter of what parts went into what parts. It's really the question of non-consensual sexual conduct and whether or not people knew or knew before the fact, or even these young men knew before the fact, that this was in fact rape as opposed to some other form of sexual abuse. There's no way they didn't know that what they were doing was a form of sexual assault.
And how do you weigh, Julius is thinking about these young men, and of course this is not the first time this kind of after conversation has gone on, and the rest of their lives and the stigma, how do you weigh that stigma on them for this one night, Marianne, against there's also social messaging for the whole country here in terms of understanding right and wrong?
I think that social messaging is really, really important. I am much less concerned about the impact or the supposed impact this is going to have on these young men's lives. They have done something willfully and maliciously, and they are now going to have to suffer some consequences of that, although one could argue that they're actually not suffering much, given the fact that they were charged as juveniles and won't mm-hmm. be facing all that much time. But the idea that we need to be sympathetic to the fact that their lives, quote-unquote, might be ruined, I mean, this is what happens when people do bad things to other people, or at least it's what should happen. And I think the Attorney General was right to say that this is not a Steubenville restricted idea. This is something that happens all across our nation, all across the world, and they just happen to get caught. But the social message needs to be, we need to be having a conversation about treating girls and women as human beings and not as objects of sexual entertainment or consumption.
That certainly was the message from the victim's mother. This was, you may have heard this, but delivered a statement to defendants Trent Mays and Malik Richman from in front of the courthouse yesterday.
You displayed not only a lack of this compassion, but a lack of any moral code. Your decisions that night affected countless lives, including those most dear to you. You were your own accuser through the social media that you chose to publish your criminal conduct on. This does not define who my daughter is. She will persevere, grow, and move on. I have pity for you both. I hope you fear the Lord, repent for your actions, and pray hard for his forgiveness.
The victim's mother, after the verdict was delivered yesterday, Ellie in Calais, Vermont. Ellie, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. The last caller, Julia, said that's so disturbing to hear somebody say that, you know, maybe he wouldn't have thought it was so wrong either. And I wonder, where were this girl's friends, you know, either male or female? Why wasn't anybody else there protecting her, you know, and taking care of her? And I think that is connected to the casualness that the prevalence of social media has created, is that it continues to, you know, it's sort of a dehumanizing disconnection. We don't see that unconscious young girl as a person. And therefore, you know, people are saying, well, maybe it's not so wrong.
Yeah. Ellie, let us pick it up right there. I appreciate your call. Juliet, take us back to that night from your reporting. Ellie says, where were her friends? Where were others intervening? What did happen, Juliet, that allowed this to just go on and on and on?
Well, the party started at actually an assistant coach's house, an assistant coach on the football team's cool. house, mm-hmm. where all the kids were drinking vodka and slushy drinks with vodka, and the girl was consuming a lot of alcohol, so much alcohol that she was ended up vomiting on the street outside. And actually, one of her friends had testified later in the trial that she had tried to pull her friend back to come back into the party and not mm-hmm. leave with the boys, mm-hmm. but she said that the victim had hit her and was very adamant on leaving with the boys and had left with the boys. But at one point, I think it was a baseball player had bet people $3 to urinate on the girl when she was on the ground throwing up.
Oh.
So
did
her
that
friends,
happen? They, do we know from the?
We don't know if that had happened, mm-hmm. but we know by at first somebody had tweeted that some people deserve to be urinated on, or they said it in a little more crass of a way. But in the trial, it came out that this one boy had bet people $3 to do it. And her friends were there. They said they couldn't control her. Other people said that she had been drinking heavily and was pretty much unconscious most of the night.
A bad, bad night. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sue in Ohio, Akron, Ohio. Sue, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This happened to me 42 years ago.
What do you mean, Sue?
I was in college. I was at a fraternity party with some friends. I got very drunk, and I was raped by a number of men.
What was the aftermath?
Nothing, because there was no social media then.
Did you try to bring charges?
No, because I had no recollection of what happened. Absolutely none.
So what are you thinking as you look at the Steubenville case and social media? Thank heavens we now have a way of recording all this, or good Lord, what's on those young men's minds when they're recording this and making these disparaging comments?
I have mixed feelings. I'm thinking, thank God that we do have this. It makes it much more humiliating for this young girl. I know this, but I have had no way of healing over all these years.
And in a way, if there had been, I mean, she awoke the next morning to a trail of text and stuff started coming to her, in addition to mm-hmm. others, that recreated the night before, piece by painful piece. Would you have rather have seen that, witnessed that, gone through that in order for some justice to be done, Sue?
Not justice to be done to me. I could have known what happened and begun to get some counseling and been able to let it go. It's been 40 years ago, and this is a trigger event for me now.
Sue, I appreciate your call. I hope it helps you to think this all through. I'm sure it's also brought it back in a tough way, but I appreciate your call. Marianne Franks, on balance, there's the brutality of some of this social media. There's also the record that it creates, which has led here to court and the judge's verdict, justice.
It has done both, but again, I think it's important for us to think about what actually happens before the fact, before the crime actually happens. How do we get to a culture where you have a group of star athletes, the group of good men, the nice guys, who look at a drunk, vomiting, stumbling girl and see an opportunity? That is something we really have to be worried about, and how much social media plays into that is really, I think, better illustrated by the kinds of ways that these young men represented themselves and their actions on that social media. It does provide us this really fascinating entryway into what they're thinking and what they're feeling, and I think that as a culture we are in something of denial about that, about the idea that nice guys can rape young girls and can take advantage of people. And so this is testimony against themselves in some respects, but when you look at their attitudes, when you look at how this was all a game to them and how they're referring to her being dead or how raped she is at this point, you see that this is all part and parcel of a certain type of culture that glorifies a certain form of male bonding at the expense of young girls and women.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Steubenville rape case, social media outrage, and now a verdict guilty on two young men who are behind bars now and will stay there for some time. Juliet McCurr reported early and deeply on this case for the New York Times. She's a sports writer there, covers the Olympics, sports, doping, and legal issues. In December, she and her colleague Nate Schweber went very deep, part of the attention brought on by social media reporting on this that brought it back to light and into the judicial system and resulted in this verdict. Marianne Franks is with us, associate professor of law at the University of Miami. She pays a lot of attention to cyber law and gender. She's written a lot on online sexual harassment. In March, on an episode of ESPN's Outside the Lines, blogger Alexandria Goddard, who helped bring attention to the whole social media record of that night, said she was floored by the lack of compassion and empathy for the victim in the social media record that she found.
There were all these kids at various parties, and they knew that this girl was unconscious and being taken from place to place, and no one stood up to do anything.
No one stood up to do anything. But a couple of days later, at a press conference in Steubenville, the local police chief, Bill McCafferty, blamed internet bloggers for the negative publicity he said the city had received, including the allegations of a cover-up.
Most of the bad publicity has come from the social media, and unfortunately today that's where a lot of people get their information like it's true, and they believe whatever's out there, and it's simply not true.
Marianne Franks, what about that? What about recreating a crime the judge has determined in this case from social media? Is it evidence like any other evidence? How's it handled? What's its weight? What about the police chief's allegation that, well, you've got a lot that's just not true?
Well, it's interesting that he should characterize social media as this separate entity from anything else that's out there. The idea that social media is anything other than anything, I mean, it's just like anything else we have. It's the way that people talk about themselves. It's the presentations they give of themselves. It's a collective. It's a way of sharing. It's another form of communication. It's not a different animal from any of the other ways that we discuss or share things with each other. So it's not this thing that we can oppose real evidence to or real facts to. There is no such thing as a fact that stands by itself. Everything has to be interpreted, especially when we're trying to recount past events. And certainly it provides opportunities for people to hurt each other and to spread certain kinds of information much more quickly and efficiently than they used to. And that's something we do need to take into account. But the social media, whatever that might mean, is really just made up of the individuals who are themselves participating in it. And that's something we have to deal with.
The Attorney General of Ohio saying, you know, a grand jury is going to be convened here, and there may be more to come here. It sounds as though he's talking about people who were sharing information online, maybe because they knew things that they didn't report but were required to or should have been required to. In a couple of months ago, CNN talked to a member of the online activist group Anonymous. You've seen them in their Guy Hawks masks there in Steubenville. Here's one with the initials KY wearing that mask and using a voice scrambler. This young man condemned the students who witnessed the rape and did not report the crime, saying the online community counts as a jury of their peers.
They incriminated themselves by posting that information online. They took part in criminal activities. And if you think that they're guilty, that's because your conscience is telling you that they are guilty.
Marianne, what about the legal culpability of those who were texting and tweeting and photographing that night?
Well, there's various theories on which they could be prosecuted. If, in fact, they knew that a crime was in progress and they failed to report it, that certainly raises legal implications. It might even rise to the level of aiding and abetting, depending on the way that Ohio law defines that. And I think, though, also important, is to think about the social implications of what does it mean to know that there were maybe dozens of people who knew about this, maybe even witnessed it happening, and all they could do was really make fun of it and joke about it and share it and talk about it as though it were some entertaining night's activity, especially if we're considering that some of the people who knew about it were likely authority figures, were adults, people who really, really should have known better.
That weird just laughter, mockery of it is very, very striking. Is that something from time immemorial, or is there something new in our social media age, Marianne, that encourages that callous response to what they're seeing?
It's hard for us to know, because the interesting thing about social media is that it brings to light things maybe we've never seen before, but not necessarily that didn't exist before. So we know that we've had a problem in this country, well, in the entire world has had a problem with sexual violence for as long as anybody knows anything about society. And we've always had a problem with recognizing rape as a crime that's committed against the actual victim, as opposed to recasting it as some sort of social problem or some sort of matter of honor or some matter of, you know, male property. So this is something we've always had a problem with, and we've, I think, had a problem with turning this into entertainment or turning the sexual objectification of women and girls into entertainment. That's probably – we've seen the rise of that because of modern society generally, because of television, because of any number of other things. So what we're seeing now, I think, is really the product of a continuing ignorance and continuing contempt for what sexual assault actually means, and this disregard for what it means to respect women and girls as equal human beings. So we're seeing it now in a way that is a little bit more raw, possibly a little bit more unfiltered, because it has become increasingly less acceptable to be open about one's disrespect for women. And so there's a sense in which maybe we can hide that under a veneer of respectability, and we might let our guard down when it comes to social media, when it comes to Facebook, when it comes to sending pictures around. And this is really coming back to haunt some of the people who are doing this.
Let's go to Taylor, calling from Oklahoma City in Oklahoma. Taylor, thank you for calling. You're on the air, Taylor.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I'm 24 years old, and I know a lot of girls that have been through similar situations, and I think it's so brave that this girl came forward to tell her story. And I think it's great that these boys were actually brought to justice, because I think a lot of times people just, you know, dismiss it like it was her fault for getting too drunk. And I think it's important that parents need to teach their teenage daughters that, hey, you need to, you know, be diligent. You know, don't just drink because it's wrong to drink underage, but don't drink because people can take advantage of you. And parents can teach their teenage sons, don't take advantage of girls just because they're in this altered state. And I think it's just something that we need, just parents and children need to be more aware of in general.
Taylor, may I ask you, when you say, you know, you're 24, you know a lot of girls who have been through similar situations, that's very striking to me, and this looks so raw, so bad. Are you saying there's something common about what exactly here? This level of inebriation, this kind of sexual abuse, assault, even rape, when girls are drunk, that looks familiar, even common to you?
Yeah, I mean, just you hear about these situations a lot, you know, like going to college, you know, at fraternity parties or just parties outside. It doesn't even have to be at a fraternity, but like just people in general, especially when you're in college, like, or whenever you're like a senior in high school, I feel like that's especially around the time where this happens, where kids just like drink a lot. They just don't know their limits. They're probably just started drinking, you know, whenever they're a freshman in college, they're just getting away from home, like being out from underneath their parents' wings. And it's like, it's almost like to them, this is okay, because like for the boys, it's okay to take advantage of them because they're not saying no. And the girls are too afraid to press charges, because whenever they do, it's like they're on trial because they're the sluts. And they're the one, like, they're the guilty party in the situation, and these boys are just being boys. I feel like that's kind of the culture around the whole thing, is where the boys are, like, it's almost like, oh, well, you know, they weren't in the wrong, because that's just what boys do. And, like, the girl's the slut because she put herself in that situation. And I just think it's really unfortunate because, I mean, I think if you talk to pretty much any girl around my age, you'll kind of hear the same thing, that, like, they've heard about these girls being taken advantage of in this way, but the girls are so ashamed they don't want to come forward and tell their stories. And I think, you know, the more exposure that this gets, this is wrong, and, like, boys can be punished for it. And I think maybe more girls will start to come forward and won't be so ashamed and realize that maybe this isn't their fault and that, you know, they're not alone.
Yeah, Taylor, I appreciate your call from Oklahoma City. Juliet, I mean, I won't make you speak as an expert here, but you looked closely at this, and you've got life experience. Does this look like some new magnification of this kind of scene in our culture, like a more prevalent sort of, you know, everybody gone wild scene, or is this just an old dynamic that we're seeing because social media captures it?
Yeah, I'm not an expert on this for sure, but I could say that this has been happening forever. Just because it's been on social media now, we're being more cognizant of it, but let's say in 1989 there was the big Glenridge rape case in Glenridge, New Jersey, where a bunch of star football players in another town, much bigger town, that really loved his football team, they were accused and eventually convicted of sexually assaulting a mentally retarded young girl. And it made national news and was a big deal for a long time, and just showed that this happens all the time, probably, like the attorney general in Ohio said, happens every Friday night and Saturday night. But I would argue that it happens every other night of the week also, especially with a group of kids like this who are taught to be invincible or learn to be invincible because their football team is really the heroes of the town, more than any of the coaches or any of the mayors or principals. And people loved their football team, and they could do anything.
Marianne, is this just in the sports circles? I have a feeling it's not. I don't want to pin all this on. I mean, certainly there can be pride and hubris and arrogance, or you name it, can go along with that. But this isn't just in sports circles, is it? You're not suggesting that, are you?
No, certainly not. I think it's the attitude that we're looking at, the sense that boys and men can do whatever they would like, you know, and have whatever the aftermath be, really focused on the victim and about what she might have done. This isn't limited to athletes by any means. If you look at one of the last horrible cases in 2009 at Richmond High School, where a 15-year-old girl was raped for 2.5 hours, and nobody called the police or tried to intervene, there were various people participating in that assault, maybe as many as 20, and they weren't all athletes. This is something deeper and broader for our culture. We may see highly concentrated forms of it with athletes because you do get some of the really explicit hero worship there that you might not get in every other context. But just as a general rule, this is a masculinity problem. This is a boys and men problem. It's not just an athlete problem.
We're looking at the Steubenville rape case. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Marianne, let me ask you something else here. I'm not sure quite how to put this, but I wonder if, I don't want to put blame on the girl, but are girls in a more empowered era getting themselves closer to danger, partying down harder, and as a result getting closer to these situations where you may run into boys, young men behaving badly?
On one level, you could say so, excuse me, in the same sense that when women entered the workforce, they also brought themselves closer to certain forms of danger. As soon as women walk out of the house, they open themselves up to certain dangers. So is it true that by living a fuller life, you also encounter more risks? Yes, you do. But I don't know what message we should take away from that, except to ask ourselves, why is this a risk that women and girls especially have to face? It's not as though women and girls are getting more drunk on the weekends than the boys and the men are. But the boys and the men are not getting sexually assaulted. So I think the question we really have to ask is, however wise we think certain choices might be, we have to ask ourselves why there's an extra burden and a specific kind of burden put on women and girls that does not seem to apply to boys or to men, and ask ourselves whether we think it makes any sense to say, you know, in addition to worrying about the stupid things you might do when you're drunk, or the fact that you might fall into a swimming pool or say something bad to your friends, you also need to worry about getting sexually assaulted, as opposed to actually saying, boys and men, don't take this as an opportunity. Don't take someone's drunkenness as an opportunity to sexually assault them. It strikes me as an odd emphasis and an insincere one.
Mm-hmm. John in Charleston, South Carolina. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was originally made aware of the story online and through social media, where the response was, you know, universally negative and condescending of the obvious criminal actions that happened here. But I would have been content to just kind of listen to your program. But the gentleman that called a few minutes ago and was making a kind of a boys will be boys and worrying about the stigma that they're going to have to endure for the rest of their lives. There's no way that even enters the picture for me, and there's no way that there's even any acceptability to what they did, and anybody could think that. And I worry more about what would happen if they aren't held to task for their actions and what kind of adults they develop into.
Yeah, John, fair point. Our time is short. I want to get one more, but I appreciate your call from Charleston. One more in Nashville. Scott, you're on. Thank you, John. Scott, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
I wanted to say the thing about the male caller ahead of him as well, is that for that to even enter somebody's mind to think it would be okay, that they might do something the same, is just unbelievable to me. Where is our human empathy gone? I mean, as a society, when you, if you're going to progress as a society without empathy, where are we going to go with one another? You just think that it's okay. Forget that it's a female. I mean, it's a person that was carried out, essentially described as a dead body. I mean, on social media, and they thought that would be okay.
Scott,
I just don't understand as a society where we would go.
Where's the empathy? Not the first time empathy has been gone missing in human interactions, but certainly one brought really vividly into our faces, into our consciousness by social media here. Juliet, what do you think overall? Social media, does it make more of a cheering section or more of a posse for justice in the end in a case like this?
Well, I think it could be both. I mean, you know, I think that one point that I wanted to make that I guess one of the callers had raised that the girl came forward or felt empowered enough to come forward and to tell her story. She actually did not come forward. Her parents were the ones who got some of these, saw some of these things online, saw the video online and some of the photos and gathered them together and brought them to the police. So the girl did not come forward at all. So I would think that it's a powerful tool in terms of justice in these cases. And it could really go both ways. It could provoke people into thinking about these issues, but it could also obviously prove as a lot of good evidence for prosecutors who are going after these issues. So I think it could do both things.
Marianne, in a word, more ammunition here for justice or for exploitation in social media?
It's going to depend entirely on the people who use it and how they choose to use it. If we're going to use social media as a way to shame and harass and humiliate certain sectors of our population, or whether we're actually going to use it to bring justice, I think it's really up to us.
Thank you both. We're out of time. Marianne Franks, Juliet McClure. This is On Point.